Basically, when I put together these slides last night, I started out with what I thought was a fairly simple strategy. I put together, kind of glued together two presentations that were done at the Semantic Technology conferences over the last couple of years, and I figured I could just pull out a handful of slides, get some of the basic ideas across, and then actually run you through an exercise based on a methodology I developed for a large telecommunications equipment manufacturer in the Bay Area. That I don't know if I can name them, or it's been years, but you know, there might be still be some non-disclosure running around. The problem was, as I went through the slides, I went, well, that one's pretty good, and that one's pretty good, and that one's pretty good. And by the time I was done, I think I had 60 slides. So my goal is to get through these in about 10 minutes, and then go through the exercise. I don't think I will succeed. And because of that, I'll be moving quickly. I will not be covering everything on every slide. That information's there, so you can go pick it up later if you're interested. But if I am going too fast, by all means, slow me down, stop me. And I'll spend more time on specific topics. So this is kind of the work of what we affectionately call or regard ourselves as the ontology management team. I'll describe them in a little bit of detail. And then look at the issues of semantics being dynamic, and take a look at some approaches and strategies that we've been kind of thinking through over the last couple of years for how to deal with this phenomenon of dynamic semantics, what happens when meanings change within the human and social ontologies that we work with. So first off, the ontology management team, kind of an outgrowth of Ontolog. Bob, needless to say, is a heavy participant. Bo Newman participates every once in a while. And there's another gentleman I've been working with for about 10 years now, Joe Beck, who's now with Eastern Kentucky University. A lot of the values-based concepts that you'll see are really kind of an outgrowth of his work. So what's ontology management team all about? Well, the key thing is, as we were looking at a lot of discussion on ontology engineering, we began to feel there was kind of something missing. And that was the management practices that would support and enable effective ontology engineering projects. So that kind of was the starting point for this. The approach we're trying to take is to bridge these theoretical problem engineering domains, come up with kind of a general set of management principles that would apply in ontology development. We're also suspecting that it will also help deal more effectively with policy development activities in large enterprises. We tend to focus more on the what we call the natural ontologies, the individual and social ontologies, the way people conceptualize and the way they reach agreement around those conceptualizations as a prerequisite for formalization and engineering exercises. These policy vectors, I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. I think it just does a pretty good job of explaining a little bit kind of where we're coming from, how we approach these things. Here for future reference. And with that, I've saved a number of minutes. We're into the first issue. So what do we mean by this idea of dynamic semantics? Well, the core of the argument is that meaning changes through time, and there's actually this flow through from these personal individual ontologies into the social agreements around those. Then you'll have some sort of engineering or formalization exercise to create those explicit ontologies, which are used by automated agents. And that's kind of the general chain of thought. The problem, however, is that people change their minds. And the way they think today is not the way they think tomorrow. And the agreements you have today are not necessarily agreements that you'll be able to hold tomorrow. And all that churn can, if not properly addressed or considered, impact adversely your formalization exercises and limit the functionality that you're trying to automate. And it's kind of the flip side from the other direction. Formalization does not in of itself stabilize meaning, because it's not an inherent property, but it's associated through human interaction and human thought. And I think I said most of this, or enough of it. So what's the approach that you can take for this? Well, the first one we started working with is the idea of taking a look at what we consider the transformational origins of these semantic changes. And let's see, anything I want to say here. A couple of models, knowledge vector model, that's what we're really going to focus on a bit. And then an extension of that, what we're calling the meta-knowledge continuum model. So this is the basic knowledge vector model. This is courtesy of Bo Newman. This is stuff he's been working on for about 20 years. And the basic idea is data is transformed information, which is transformed into knowledge. That knowledge is used to enable a knowledge utilization event, effectively an action or a decision. And this is kind of a standard model that we use in understanding knowledge management, knowledge policy generally. The key caution here is that the boundaries between data, information, and knowledge are not necessarily discrete. you can view those as sort of a continuum, but at the same time there is some sort of elevation of semantic meaning through time that differentiates data from knowledge. And so this model kind of gets into that idea, that when we're dealing with data artifacts, there's a set of metadata that is associated with those artifacts in that form. When you're at the informational level, there's a different, slightly different set of properties that could be associated with it, and the same with meta-knowledge. Now, what this does then is really set the stage for a series of semantics. And so we've taken this range of semantics and we've broken it down now in terms of kind of classes of semantics. And the first one that we've identified is interpretive semantics. These are associated with data. As you move up into the informational realm, then you're dealing with semantics that tend to deal more with context. A couple principles here. When we're getting into knowledge and behaviors, you're looking at aspirational semantics. These tend to be the goals and the drivers. And then finally, behavioral semantics. Now, these are critically important, and if you take a look at a lot of really the high-end formalizations that are taking place, semantic formalization involves really trying to pin down and make explicit critical behavioral semantics. And so the key thing here that kind of helped us is this anchors a lot of the axiomatic formalization, but recognize there are other semantic properties as well that are critical to making sense of this information and making it actionable. And those other categories can become important, perhaps even more important than the behavioral semantics. So this gave us kind of a general strategy, trying to formalize this meta-knowledge. And if you're going to try to address the change, what can you do? Well, three simple options. I'm sure there are more. You can ignore the volatility. Just ignore the fact that meaning is going to change through time and figure, you know, we've got a system, it works. You can try to stomp it. You can say, no, this is the meaning and we're going to hold to that and we're not going to allow the meaning to shift or change. And then the last one is really the idea of embracing, trying to recognize it will change and make sure that your systems and processes and policies address that. Semantic nirvana, and this was just kind of a real simple way of looking at a lot of the formalization that people get excited at, thinking that's going to be a major solution for this issue. The problem we see with a lot of this fully formalized predicate logic is it's really a two-step semantic resolution model. There's symbol identification. Once you've matched the symbol to a concept, now we're going to define that concept axiomatically in terms of behavioral semantics, and we're leaving entire classes of semantics effectively undefined. And it's up to the humans to provide those, and if it's not formalized in any way, and it's up to human interpretation, then that can cause breakdowns through time. So key findings here, you know, uncertainty's out there, and it's difficult to formalize around it, but if you can understand where the change is coming from and then document to your best understanding, that will tend to give you an ability to handle the changes more rationally through time. And so because of that, we developed this concept of meta-knowledge formalization. And the idea is to really take a look at each of those semantic classes, figure out which ones are critical for the application or agreement space that you're dealing with, and then go ahead and start formalizing those. When the full presentation, we actually gave, I think it was about a half dozen examples of where this principle had been applied in specific applications and which classes of meta-knowledge, which semantic classes, were actually dominant or predominant in those applications. Some of the benefits, although without seeing the examples, I don't know this is going to make a lot of sense. You can get into this fairly easily. It doesn't have to be a huge capture everything, but more capture what you know about the knowledge and its rationale as you go along. It relies on the existence of implicit and tacit knowledge within the organization and actually leverages that in a way that's fairly interesting. And the key thing was we saw this really as a starting point for trying to come up with some rational ontology management practices, which is really what drove us there in the first place. Excuse me. Another approach, and this is really from the presentation we made this year, focuses on human values and the role of human values in semantic association. And our belief was that if we have a better understanding of the mechanisms and dynamics associated with that, that may give us another way of dealing with some of these trickier semantic codification issues. And the basic point here is that values can be considered a technology because decision making is expensive. To go back through and rethink everything time and time again takes a lot of time, takes a lot of effort, and you know, if a tiger's going to jump out and grab you, you may not have time to actually think through big and furry and hairy and big teeth, and I see a claw, let's see the teeth, well, that could hit me in the head, claw could hit me in the body. You know, you may not have time to think through all that. So if we can speed up decision making somewhat, That tends to be beneficial in many contexts, and we see values really as one of the key mechanisms that humans use to do that. Values effectively abstract or decontextualize knowledge in order to make it generalizable and reduce the processing in order to apply basic rules in similar or even sometimes dissimilar contexts. The problem, however, and this is kind of one of the issues with going down this road, is that just as it can make a decision more instantaneous, more automated, it may not be contextually appropriate. And so we also see in enterprises where a dominant value system may actually drive detrimental or inappropriate behaviors. And so the trick is to know when are the values helping you, when are the values hurting you. And needless to say, values are going to have some impact in meaning generally. Some of the organizational issues, I think you've probably experienced all these, if not thought about them on occasion. So to get back to how values work and how they impact semantics, we go back to that knowledge vector model. And the point being that really all those transformations are where the expense comes from. And how many of you are in academics or had to be in academics or pretend to be in academics or remember academics and had to work with the scientific method? The first time you applied it, did you get it correct? Probably not. So going through all the steps and making everything explicit, we can do it, but that isn't the way we necessarily work on a day-to-day basis. And so this process, although it exists, is not the way that things tend to go all the time. So what we find in the real world is we take all these knowledge vectors, these D to I to K, KU thingies, and that becomes a body of experience. And through time, we're going to synthesize it. We're going to figure out which of those patterns we can trust, what we believe in, what we consider perceived truth or reliability. That then gets elevated to the concept of values, at least in this model. And then wisdom is basically, in this model, the ability to balance competing values and choose the correct or appropriate optimizations in a given context. So just some quick definitions. Anything I need to get here? I think really the main point to walk away with is the idea that this dissociation is a form of knowledge compression, that we're taking that body of experience, we're synthesizing it or compressing it, reducing it to a smaller set of knowledge artifacts, so you don't have to go back and interact with all that experience in every case. And this basically just takes the model that I showed you earlier, renames it slightly. Instead of talking about meta-knowledge, we're talking really about semantic segmentation. So it really just kind of reinforces the one that you saw before, changes the labeling a little bit. And now we're going to look at the impact of values on semantic association. Again, not going to go into a lot of detail here, but the point being that we can identify mechanisms whereby a value system is going to impact the association of meaning within each of those segments. And this then serves as a basis for further understanding and analytical methodologies. A lot in contextualization. What patterns you see are the patterns that you are able to see, have been trained to see, have seen before usually. Aspirational semantics, a lot of area for conflict there, value systems, especially value conflict, and then finally behaviors. And then, you know, no presentation like this can possibly be complete without the requisite Dilbert cartoon. And so here they're going to talk about their values, and their values are very simple. Results, or what was it? I need my glasses for this one. Bias for action and passion for results, but you'll notice the meaning of those two values is not necessarily clear to Wally. And then the basic conclusions from this module, values, not facts, drive decisions. And because of this, and this was kind of how we pitched the presentation, values, the ultimate semantic technology. We figured that'd be kind of something the technologists would find amusing, if not adversarial. And then we kind of looked at some of these values-based methods and kind of revisiting them again. And we actually had a few conversations, at least with an outfit based in Colorado, and trying to do some ontology-based or values-based ontology development. So use values as a framework for actually codifying the semantic properties as opposed to using other mechanisms. Not quite sure how that'll work, but it looks like it might have some promise. Certainly as an adjunct to axiomatic-based approaches, and when you're getting into the consensus area, values tend to become absolutely critical, and so it certainly has application there. Well, with that, I got through this in 12 minutes. Was that fun? I feel like I accomplished something. And so at this point, with the fast flurry, let's go do any catch. Anybody have any questions before I move on to the next piece? It was overwhelming or it was obvious? Overwhelming? Well, I can try to underwhelm. Anybody want me to say anything else on any particular? I'm not getting much feedback here. Okay. So let's kind of go the next step and say, how would this work in the real world? And so we have here what we're going to describe. I'm going to describe a semantic consensus acceleration process. In the first iteration, it was actually called CAT, for consensus acceleration teams, but I don't have a team in front of me today, so I've turned it into a generic process. The idea here is that, and this came from a large telecommunications company, and the basic issue they were facing was metadata interoperability. You know, numerous systems all over the place built by individual teams, and they got to the point where they could not exchange information between them. Systems that should be able to match up with each other simply couldn't. And part of the, they initially thought it was a metadata issue, and it was. But the path that we took to solve it was actually to start with something fairly simple, and that was to normalize, please.
What's your
name, metadata? So I have a document. What data do I have stored about that document? So what product does it pertain to? Who wrote it? When was it written? Maybe I've got a graphic. What's that graphic about? Okay, so they had all these databases and document systems out there. And when you looked at the databases that managed those things, you know, the various fields and properties should line up, but they didn't. And so you couldn't easily take information from engineering and get in a technical documentation system and have it fit where it needed to go. Someone had to look at it and interpret it and figure out how to make it fit. Well, that works for relatively small things, but when you're dealing with, you know, what, 500 software releases and maybe a couple thousand products, you know, just at that point, having a human figure out each one of those breaks down. And in fact, the products was actually one of the primary examples that drove the strategy. I did one quick little afternoon study. I found 25 variations on the same product name. Well, as humans, they could read that and understand what product was being talked about, but the search and retrieval systems couldn't actually index 25 variations and assign them all to the same product. And so the focus here was, let's standardize that terminology, let's standardize the corporate language, and needless to say, there were going to be some semantic issues associated with standardizing the language, and that's why this became effectively a semantic exercise. The approach that we took was to use cross-cultural teams. So we got people from marketing, engineering, technical documentation, personnel, and anybody else who you know really wanted to participate. It was a pretty open process. And the reason we did that is because we knew that the basic value system, the mindset, and the way that they assign meaning to these names and terms and concepts was going to change across those groups. And that was the consensus that we were trying to accelerate, the consensus of terminology and meaning across these diverse communities. We gave them basically what we call a semantic work package. We went in and took a variety of databases and systems, went in, extracted the terms, literally concepts, but really it was terminology based, and then organized them and clustered them in terms of in groups of related terms. Please.
Back to your definition of metadata, you've got some examples. You know, those things that you mentioned are sort of properties of the document.
Right.
So that's not really meta to me if I'm thinking about documents. If you're thinking about what's containing the document, then you're reasoning that way. And I there's a little sloppiness, and not sloppiness, but confusion around that particular term. I think that was a good question to ask. And, you know, I mean, when you were talking about metadata, I was thinking maybe we were talking about a higher level thing than that.
Right. Well, and that's, I think, that was one of the reasons we introduced the term meta-knowledge as opposed to just metadata. Because metadata seems to be the stuff that's focused on what do we know about the data object, right? But when we get into the informational aspects of it, then context becomes important and classification becomes important. Okay, and so that can be considered a type of metadata, but since we're really talking about something a little different than just data elements, I think the term meta-knowledge becomes a little more useful there. And, you know, and to extend that, right, then when we're looking at the knowledge artifact itself, well, what were the things that went into the transformation from it being simply information to knowledge? What made it actually able to drive a behavior or a decision? And so that's another set of properties or another set of semantics that could be associated with it. And then finally, the aspirational ones. What are you trying to accomplish? Am I building a car? Am I building a rocket? Am I trying to dig a ditch? And those aspirational semantics then will put really another set of meta properties layered. That's the more interesting stuff. Yeah, definitely, but it's the harder to explain. So I gave the simple explanation, but the point of this model is to try to recognize there's a really broad continuum out here. And I find the term metadata, although a lot of people use it, actually, like you say, to not be as useful because people think they understand it when there are like 12 or 13 different schools of thought out there. Yeah. I don't know if that helped answer the question or not. I don't know. So anyway, the idea was here, we give them a set of terms, have them identify the various concepts that are related to it, relate them, differentiate them, come up with some initial definitions, and then try to reach agreement on what this stuff all means. The key thing here, I think, is pretty critical, is that these teams were not engineering teams. You know, we may have had people from engineering, but they weren't necessarily language engineers. And we weren't trying to get them to come up with complete ontological formalizations. We're trying to get them to define a consensus point that would effectively function as a requirement or a set of specifications to the ontology engineering groups. And so here's the process. Once they're given a set of terms, do some research. Go out and poke around, look these things up in Google or on your internal website and see what you can find out. And kind of the key thing there is that list complete, is that set complete, or are there some other terms and resources that should be brought into the conversation and understood? Next step is this idea of inventorying the semantics. This is where we're trying to get from terminologies into concepts. So try to identify the concepts that are associated with these terms and either define or identify some working definitions. What do we mean by these concepts? Identify the core concept. What's really the main thing that all this stuff hinges on? And look at how the other terms and concepts relate back to this core concept. Try to get some idea of what the relationships look like. You know, make pictures if you can. Step three, begin to normalize the semantics. Go back and take a look at those definitions now. Try to refine the working definitions into something that's actually publishable and could be used going forward. Let's try to really anchor those concepts. Validate those definitions. Is the definition complete? Does it address the corner cases? Is it missing stuff? Whatever. And of course, document the supporting rationales. Becomes really critical at this point. And then once that's been done, and this was really one of the primary goals of this project, so we had a specific step for normalizing the terminology. For each concept, what's the term that should be used by the vast majority of people when trying to describe this concept? What's the best product name when we're trying to document a product name?
Can you say a little bit more about how you validate your working?
Well, it was really the idea of, you know, is it complete? Does it describe all of what you're talking about? And where we found the particular issues were really in the boundaries of the corner cases. Does it define a clean line saying this is in and that's out? And it's those boundary conditions that we saw most of the debate and focus on. And the reality was, given the time that these teams were allowed to work on this stuff, because it was a very accelerated schedule, the definitions we got were fairly shoddy. But with it, we got the list of issues, and that told us where we needed to focus to try to clarify later. One of the best examples I've seen within the last week or so on this is the definition of clouds.
Clouds.
Evidently, there's a big issue in meteorology today because the definition of clouds has been completely destabilized. Definitions that have been placed for decades have broken. Anybody tell me why? That's really cool. Huh? We're used to looking up at clouds, and all the definitions were based on us sitting on Earth looking up at clouds. Now, how do meteorologists look at clouds? They look down at clouds. The definitions no longer work. And they don't have the new ones yet, and they're trying to figure them out. And specifically those boundaries and corner cases, because they're getting additional detail that they didn't have before, right? Additional dynamics that weren't being considered before, additional properties, additional considerations, additional implications for different semantic properties. And so the whole thing's kind of in a state of flux.
Doesn't that argument for holding your definition in the cloud based on what you understand of physics versus what you understand of observations?
That could be more stable.
Wouldn't you get a more robust definition?
Yeah. Yeah, probably. How about truth? I mean, it works for some stuff. There you go. Yeah, so I think, you know, going back to fundamentals works for some stuff, it may not work for other stuff.
There's a big tension, right? Play the next point about it. We're looking, no stock are coming up.
Oh, no, please.
So there is a big tension there. Look for consensus. Is this a social document, an ontology, a social document that lets us all talk about things in common? Or we try to understand some sort of physical truths or objective truths that will withstand some of this dynamic process that you're talking about understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that. I know it bothers me all the time.
I think the answer is yes, because sometimes you can do one and it's optimal, and other times you can't do it and you got to use something else. And one of the best examples we had out of these teams, I remember one, and we formed this team and we had this guy from marketing. And, I mean, he was sharp. He came in and he spoke, and the words were, you know, they're like oil paintings. They're just full and rich, and you went, I could just sit here and listen to you. It's wonderful, it's wonderful. And the team was focusing on switch and router. And he knew the answer. And he was very helpful. Blah, 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 and blah, 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 blah. Cool. Then they went out and did their research. Came back. Well, what about switch router? And now they're trying to define switch router in terms of the boundaries they'd put on switches and routers. And then they had a problem. And it was about four sessions. And finally, at the fourth session, he came back and he said, I just realized. I knew what this stuff was 4 years ago. In the last 4 years, it's changed, and my entire way of thinking about it doesn't even apply anymore. You know, that's kind of thing. Are we dealing with something concrete where you can break it down into constituent pieces or components or theories or foundations or laws even? Or is it something which is really far more nebulous and you're right, you're into the human realm?
It's difficult to run
what
we do right now.
Yeah.
But I think that, well, my sense of it is that push more for the objective thing because things are so bad. Because the technical world is changing so quickly and globalizing. So you take your example and then you start in Japan.
Well, like I said, I think if you can do that, it's an excellent strategy. The thing that comes to mind, however, is that most of the money in this game right now has to do with intelligence. And I don't know that there is a physics of terrorism that you can use to come up with concrete boundaries. Maybe in 50 years, I don't know.
So I have a more mundane question.
Please.
When you were dealing with the team and the different lists of terms and definitions and such, how did you collect all that information?
It was basically this. I did not sanitize this document, but this was basically what we gave the teams. And it says, are you lost in a semantic jungle? Use a cat. Wasn't that cute? I didn't do it. I devour any decision making in that. But what it had was basically the process. Here's the multi-step process laid out with a summary of deliverables. And then for each step, it was basically, this is what we're trying to get you to do, this is what we want you to think about, and this is what information or knowledge we want you to capture about it when you do it. No. No, this is a document. It was not produced by Excel. I'm sorry.
I just mean when they actually, they put those terms somewhere,
This is a Word document, so they basically just extend the table and captured it that way. Again, because this was really an input to an engineering process, it wasn't like we were going to construct huge databases of this stuff. It really tended to find the issues and the areas that need to be focused on. Now, at some point after they ran a whole bunch of these, yeah, they might have tried to get them into a database of one form or another. I'm not sure what they did. Yeah, I was a contractor. At some point, my contract ended, so the project lived on. But yeah, the basic idea was we had this mostly reduced to tables, and they could fill out and extend the tables, and then we had the data in at least a semi-structured form. We could consolidate or do whatever we needed to do to it. Something here likes me. Last thought, let's kind of bump through this, and then we'll have about a half hour to pretend to do an exercise. So look at the normative term for the concept. What's the way we should talk about this thing? What should everyone agree to, or hopefully everybody can agree to? Document the terms origins and history or pedigree. And we found that to be fairly important, again, because this stuff was changing. And was this a term that came out of engineering, or a term that came out of marketing, or a term that came from, you know, kind of standard industry origins? Alternative semantics. Is the term overloaded? Does it have multiple meanings? Because that might influence what you're looking at when we use for the normative term for the concept. And then this idea of aliases. What are the various other terms that are used to describe this concept so we can hopefully inform the indexing system of what to look for when it finds this concept? So with that, I am done with my official talk.